This is J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage. Welcome to the J.D.'s Homocore segment of my Queer Core show. I want you to listen carefully to especially the last verse of this song. There will be a quiz. Yes, that group wanted to be on the JD's Top 20 tape. That was Nikki Parasite from 1985 and the song Mail Call, and mail was spelled M-A-L-E. On this segment, you will hear every song from the famous JD's Top 10 Homocore Hit Parade tape, plus many more. And I'm delighted to also give you an interview with G.B. Jones, who with Bruce LaBruce created the JD's fanzine in Toronto in the mid-80s. GB will tell us about the zine and will also dig deep into the story of her band Fifth Column. And besides being a musician and zine publisher, she's also an artist and filmmaker. Her film Lollipop Generation is currently making the rounds of film festivals. I wanted to get your impression of what is queercore music.
Oh, that's a good question, but it's so hard to answer. It's definitely different things to different people because all the different bands that were involved and are still involved all had very different styles of music. And I think that's what's really exciting about it is that there wasn't one particular set type of music that a group had to be in order to feel like they were part of it. Like, for instance, Pansy Division, who I know you're also talking to, are like a pop-punk group. And if you look at a group like, say, God Is My Co-Pilot, they're extremely experimental, kind of free-form punk, I guess you... I hate to label groups because they always insist that you've labeled them the wrong way afterwards. But... and say Limp Wrist are like a hardcore group, and a group like $3 Bill from Chicago has, you know, you can hear punk and indie rock and a little bit of metal in their sound, and then there's the newer groups like Kids on TV and Lesbians on Ecstasy, and they've got, they're using like electronic music and synthesizers and stuff, so there's such a wide range of different kinds of music involved. I think that's what's really exciting about it. It's not like you could talk about queercore, but you're not talking about a specific genre of music.
I've been doing a lot of studying. I've read a lot about JD's, the magazine, and the tapes, and there's a lot of opinions out there, and a couple of things I've read is that JD's was seen to be sort of a catalyst that pushed the queercore scene into existence, and one person said it created a fiction that there was already a homocore movement, and people started believing it, and it sort of self-fulfilled that prophecy.
Right. I would say that's kind of true.
So this was started in the magazine, JD, so can you tell me about how JD started?
Sure. A fifth column had done the song, The Fairview Mall Story, for the album To Throw With Hate, and the guest star on the song was Bruce LaBruce, and we were writing about a police sting operation on a washroom in St. Catharines in Ontario, in Canada.
Let's hear the song Fairview Mall Story from Fifth Column's To Sir With Hate album.
The Fairview Mall Story.
Call unusual behavior in the men's public washroom at the Fairview Mall restaurant in St. Catharines. Police conducted a two-week investigation beginning in early December and involving seven officers and using video surveillance equipment.
Harder to justify is the publication and broadcast of the names of these men by several media outlets in the region. Whose interests are being served by the publicizing of these names? lives and reputations of the perpetrators, and more importantly, of their innocent families, are damaged for a long time, maybe forever. So why in the St. Catharines instance do we have this nasty business of a list of names being read over the radio?
I started thinking about different groups who had done songs about queer subjects or gay or lesbian subjects, and I was also listening to a lot of hardcore bands at that time that did have songs that had something to do with that. Whether they were pro or con, I didn't really care. I just thought it was interesting that they'd have that subject matter in the song, since we had just done this song ourselves, the band with Colin. I started finding all these songs, like there were so many of them. There was like groups like the Nip Drivers and the Angry Simones and the Dicks, and oh, I can't think of all the different groups. There were quite a few of them. I thought, wow, this is so funny. I put together a little cassette tape for friends of all these different songs that all had queer lyrics in them. And I thought, wow, it would be such a good idea. Like I kind of called the tape Homocore, and I thought, oh, it'd be such a good idea to have a fanzine just based on all these songs and the idea that like all these punk kids were doing queer songs. And so I asked Bruce, I said, do you want to do a zine? And he said, yeah, sure. So we quickly put together our first issue and got it out.
So your mixtape inspired the magazine?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and just reading the lyrics of all these different groups and reading interviews with them. A lot of them were talking about gay stuff in interviews or queer stuff. And for instance, like also a group like Nervous Gender from San Francisco, they were very public about having queer members in the group from like very early days of punk. Like they were one of the very first synth punk bands that they have lyrics about, you know, queer stuff. And of course Frank was in the group originally. That was, I think, her first group, and the other members were also queer, and they talked about that in interviews and notably in Research magazine. And this was in the late 70s, so that all kind of came into play too. And also the Dicks lead singer Gary Floyd, he wrote a lot of queer lyrics in his songs, and he talked about that in interviews as well. He was, you know, very public about it. All these things kind of came into play, and we put like some of the interview extracts with those groups in JD's, and we put a lot of their songs on our top 10 list, and that's kind of how it started, just kind of gathering together different things like songs and interviews and stuff and putting it all together.
And photography and art and...
And of course photography and art, yeah, that's true. And comics and anything we could find.
The top 10 lists fascinate me because I'm a queer music fanatic. Who put together those lists?
Bruce and I did. We just would, pick whatever songs that we had most recently found that had queer lyrics, and we'd just put them on the top 10 list, which quickly became a top 20 list.
Uh-huh.
And then we'd try and update it every time we put an issue out.
How many tapes were released?
How many of the JD's top 10 tapes?
Yes.
You know what? I never counted. I just kept making them and doing the covers, and I never ever counted how many we were doing. I know we mailed out hundreds.
How many different ones?
There's only one.
Okay. That's what I wanted to be clear of.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, the mixtape I made for myself was just something different. It was like material by other groups who had already released it on records. Like, I just taped songs from records and stuff. So we never released that commercially because...
Well, you couldn't.
No, exactly. But the songs we had in the JD's Top 10 were all songs that were either given to us by different groups or that we had recorded ourselves. So.
Okay, so there's one tape, one individual tape, and you sent out hundreds, and they're pretty rare, I guess.
Yes, I would imagine so. I have no idea, and of course, you know, Bruce was sending them out as well. I have no idea how many he sent out, and We didn't really sell them in stores. I think we sold them in a couple of stores, but they might have had some, a tiny bit of distribution at one point or another, but not to any great degree. But somehow they managed to find themselves, or people managed to find them copies, and I guess people have dubbed them for their friends and made copies of them, and it certainly has got around.
Yes, my copy, I don't know how what generation it is, but it's not an original.
It's not an original?
No.
Oh, how can you tell?
Well, I presume it doesn't have the clear sound as an original might.
They never did have really, really clear sound, I have to say.
Okay. Well,
they were not hi-fi, they were low-fi.
I know.
Very low-fi. This is how you can tell. On all the original copies, I spray-painted right on the covers. They're little stars, and I'd spray-paint them different colors. I'd spray-paint some blue and silver and orange. And so that's how you could tell if you have an original copy or not.
The artists on this tape and on the other top 10 lists weren't necessarily queer, were they?
No, some of them weren't. You know, I have no real way of knowing, actually. I don't really know a lot of them, and I didn't think that was really very important, because for us, the whole queer scene wasn't about, specifically gay and lesbian. It was a more free-for-all type attitude. You could be anything, or you could say you were nothing, or it didn't really matter. It was just about, more like letting everyone do their own thing.
Yeah. Some of those songs, I have to wonder whether they were homophobic or not.
Yeah, well, some of them, they express a kind of conflicted attitude that people had, I think, in a lot of cases. And in some of them, it wasn't quite clear what exactly they were trying to say. I know with some songs, like, say, there's a song called Faggot in the Family by Arian Disgrace. There was a big kerfuffle in Maximum Rock and Roll. Some people accused them of being homophobic and being racist because of their name. But, I mean, my impression was that people had looked at it very closely because the name is Arian Disgrace. So, obviously, they're not proud of being Arian. That's not the point they're trying to make. And in the song, I thought they were actually quite the opposite of being homophobic. I thought it was like a very, talking about the ordeal this person, queer person in the family had to go through. The kind of abuse they'd suffer at the hands of their family who couldn't deal with the fact that they were queer. I thought that's what the song was actually about. But I think that passed right over the heads of maybe well-meaning liberal people, young punk kids who were trying to be politically correct and didn't quite get the full picture.
Do it.
other songs like Homosexual by the Angry Simons. I don't know. Are you familiar with that song?
I remember that striking me as being homophobic.
Right, but apparently it was actually about Darby Crash from the Germs, who was a friend of theirs. And I think the big conflict for them was that he killed himself, and like kind of the frustration of dealing with that and trying to deal with finding out about his sexuality after he died. Or I'm sure they actually probably knew when he was alive, but maybe that was like... I think there has to be a forum for people trying to deal with these kind of things. I don't think that it's always so great to just... say only the politically correct opinions can be expressed. I think sometimes it's good to work things right out in public.
Mm-hmm.
As messy as it might become, I think that's a kind of a valuable learning experience.
I hear that calling, a blues with Canada.
from the JD's Top 10 Homocore Tape. That was Zuzu's Petals and their song, Bert, from around 1985.
Who were the Zuzu Petals?
Zuzu's Petals were a band with Bruce and with Anne McLean, who was also in Fifth Column, and with her brother Joe, and Rod and Laurel and Kelly, who played trumpet. She also played trumpet with Fifth Column on a couple of songs. There were a couple of other members who kind of came and went. It was a very kind of flexible group. Yeah, and they played around town for about a year, and they recorded one tape, and then they broke up.
I have that tape, and you did the artwork.
Yes, I did.
Looks like it was hand-colored.
It was hand-spray-painted, yes. That's right. It's the orange cover with the
yes.
silver flower?
Uh-huh.
That's right.
A friend of mine, Larry Bob, sent me a cover of the JD's tape because I'd never seen it. And not once I saw the cover, I could see more information, and it mentioned that Zuzu Petals had a cassette.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, well, let me see if I can find that. And I did, and I ordered it online. And you know who sent it to me? Who dealer was? Mikael Bord.
Oh, really? Right. He's on the JD's Top 10.
I know, Big Man.
That's right.
This is really interesting circle.
Yeah, that is. Oh, my God.
And this is a good spot to play for you, Big Man and Too Scared to Be Queer.
Oh, no, please don't put that thing in me. It'll hurt. We'll be right back.
But doesn't compare her to me, no brother.
You're in trouble.
Toilet flame trouble. Don't expect us to be nice. If they try to burn their bubble, tell you about that. You go back. But this is a murder of me, no brother.
You're in trouble.
Toilet flame trouble.
You're in trouble.
Toilet flame trouble.
Following Too Scared to Be Queer was The Toilet Slaves and Toilet Slave Trouble, which you'll hear GB describe as their experiment.
And who were the Toilet Slaves?
The Toilet Slaves were me and Bruce and a girl named Kate. And she recorded us, and we made a lot of noise. And tried to do some weird effects and stuff like that. It was our little experiment.
So how many songs were done by the Toilet Slaves?
One. Oh, maybe two? I don't remember. Now.
One song and it made the top 10. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Other than your own songs you were involved with, on the JD's Homocore tape, do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? No, I like the whole tape. I like playing the whole tape, like, and listening to all of the songs together. Sorry. Do you have a favorite?
I do. I like Nikki Parasite's song.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a great song.
And I love that it mentions wanting to be on the tape.
Right. I know. It was so funny. I know. We were so excited when we got that song. I think that was one of the first songs we got, maybe. And we thought, wow, this is just so great. This is perfect.
Again, that was the last verse of Mail Call by Nikki Parasite, as he was called then. The story goes that his band, the Parasites, didn't want to record that song, so he just did it on his own. He now goes by Dave Parasite, and he and his band have released quite a few pop-punk albums over the years, continuing to this day.
I'm speaking of not just the tape, but the magazine, the zine. What do you think the legacy is of JD's?
Well, it seems strange to me to be talking about a fanzine. How many years has it been?
Almost 20. Well,
yeah.
It ran from 85 to 91, right?
Yeah. It seems really strange to me to be talking about a zine I did 15, 20 years ago today, I have to say. And I have no way of accounting for why that's happened. I would have hoped that something really exciting would have happened because of it, but I had no way of predicting that it would have had such a lasting impact. And of course, you know, when we were first doing the first issue, which was, you know, making up all this stuff about the scene going on in Toronto, you know, it was partly a joke for us, partly fun, and partly serious, but, you know, we had no idea that so many years later we'd still be talking about it. So, yeah, it's really interesting. that that's happened, and it's kind of not something I ever would have imagined.
I can't leave out your artwork in the magazine.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, I did a lot of drawings for JD. Yeah. And they were based on drawings by Thomas Inland, and I would change the scenarios. His drawings lean more towards very standard definitions of, like, people in authority being tops in a sexual situation, and all the people who aren't authority figures being the bottom. And so I just kind of switched that around and made the juvenile delinquents the good guys and the cops the bad guys.
Well, also, I think your figures, the female figures, were more realistic looking, where his was, no one's built like that, you know.
Right, right. I modeled a few of them after people I knew, so that's probably why I did want them to be a lot more realistic. And I wanted to be able to draw some of my friends as well.
To you, what is the difference between queercore and riot girl music?
You know, with some groups, I don't think there is a difference. I know groups like, for instance, Excuse 17, who were on Donna Dress's Chainsaw label, were both a queercore group and a riot girl group at the same time. And I think that's kind of true for a lot of the women that were involved in both movements. It didn't really make any difference to them what movement they were said to be affiliated with. I think they'd probably be happy to say both of them. I think a lot of the original Riot Girls in their zines and in interviews and stuff were always played with groups like Tribe 8 and Team Drash, and you know, they toured with them, and so I don't think there was a dividing line for any of the original people involved. I don't know what happened so much later. I think once the media got hold of it and it kind of spread out throughout the world, it became more exclusively, like, identified with a kind of a feminist movement. But I think in the earlier days, it was more freeform and inclusive of, like, queer groups and queercore. And of course, you know, most of us knew all the girls involved, so, in the early days, like the original people. So, you know, there was lots of talking back and forth, and our group played with each other, and it was kind of just all, like, one big scene, really. So I don't know if I would say there was a real distinct difference. Maybe that came later, but I don't think that was true in the beginning.
A group like Bikini Kill, I don't know offhand, did they have lesbian members?
No.
So they would be more Riot Girl than queercore.
Yeah. But they were very, you know, they played with Tribe 8, and they were actually on the compilation record, There's a Dyke in the Pit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, those early records, like, I think the boy who did Outpump put both of those out, or at least one of them he put out. And,
right, Matt Wobensmith.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what was true of them is also true of the JD's Top 10 tape, is that he wasn't really concerned whether anyone was gay or straight or queer or whatever they wanted to call themselves, as long as they were interested in doing, you know, a song that had a relationship to the queer culture, then that was fine. And so I think that Bikini Kill is on that record, and along with Tribe 8 and a couple of other groups. And, you know, I think the most important thing is that the fact that they would want to align themselves with the queercore movement rather than whether there were lesbians in the group or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, you know, definitely true for us too with the JD's tape. So we were more interested in the fact that people would want to align themselves with us rather than what their sexuality would be. Because I think we could accomplish more if we had that attitude and it was, you know, more reflective of our day-to-day lives. Like, we weren't obviously living in the ghetto. You know, everyone involved in Prisville is very much against the whole ghettoization of queer people, where they all stick to one small community and, you know, only interact with each other. We wanted to be part of a much larger cultural arena.
There's much more to my G.B. Jones interview, so I had to split it into two parts. On the next part, you'll hear about her band, Fifth Column. My goal for these two segments was to play every song on the J.D.'s Top 10 Homocore tape, so here are four more. Am I the only one to notice that their Top 10 had 11 songs? Anyway, the most known of these four acts is the band Bomb. They were a San Francisco act and had several releases in the late 80s. Besides appearing on the J.D.'s tape, their song was on their 1989 cassette recording, Happy All the Time. The song is called Be a Fag.
Morning, party. Ready? Aim. Fire!
Oh, thought I was so calm, but then you saw me fire a bomb. You thought I wouldn't hurt no one, but look, here is my nice new gun. I'm gonna blow some sins away. I'm gonna do it every day. I'm gonna make those shitheads pay for beating up on Lax and Gay. Can have their baseball bat, batting even where it's at. I'm sick of all these right-wing pigs, Jesus freaks and hypocrites. They're gonna learn about real love. I'm gonna hunt them down and chuck. I'm ripping up their stupid butts. That'll teach those jerks to shut up. Thank you.
Obviously, in my opinion, I didn't save the best of them for last. After Bomb, you heard No Brain Cells from England and I'm Queer, and California artist Robert Omelette and Bang. And the noisy one at the end, that was from New Zealand, the song Tell Me Why by the band Gorse. Another one, this one from the UK, to make the JD's charts, was The Apostles. Here's their song, To Hell with Leviticus, from the 1986 album, Lives and Times of the Apostles.
They say it's wrong for one man to feel as I do toward another that well they can't admit you. You've gotta be everything that I'm trying to be. I know you're not perfect, but that doesn't matter, you see. I wanted women, but it seems they didn't want me. So I turn to you for affection, inevitably. Your beauty is timeless, though you're just 23. When I'm sitting beside you, I feel psychic energy. I feel this way because you mean so much to me.
This is the story of a lad who we shall call Paul, though it could be anyone. It begins in a dirty suburb of Birmingham, early one evening, in the two up, one down maisonette, unseen, unheard by the teenagers who occupied a room at the back. A car drew up outside, battered by the driving rain. The two lads, no obtuse meeting, was a liaison with audacity, or so the next door neighbours would have one believe. They knew everything there was to know about everybody, except what they were ignorant about, and what they didn't know they made up. Paul's father had been stalking up the spirit, yet the furtive figure climbing down from the window to the street below did not escape the cold grey glare of his red-rimmed eyes, realising something suspicious was at hand. Paul had suddenly become aware of his parents' arrival and shouted for his friend, who we should call Peter, to leave with all possible haste, this being the most expedient course of action due to Paul's father possessing an alcohol-ridden temper, the wrath of which was notorious in the old street, which we shall call Litchfield Road. Mother stumbled and father staggered through the dim passage into Paul's bedroom, and their two bleary sets of eyes regarded the unmade bed, the two pillows, their son fumbling for his clothes as if to hide the act he and Peter had evidently committed. You fucking pervert! Gasped his father in a vicious voice flavoured with fury. That night, mother wept, wailing, God forgive us for raising something inhuman in our very own house. And father howled, red rage, blue murder, white teeth in a whiskey-midden madness. For all his twisted morality was worth. Every heavy blow of a chair leg on Paul's back was punctuated by paroxysms of no son of mine's a bloody queer, while the poor wretched lad vomited over the carpet in agonizing pain under his father's vindictive purge of power. Within the hour, Paul was flashing a suitcase of clothes, a few books, mainly Michael Moorcock, Langdon Jones and J.G. Ballard, the remaining records he had managed to salvage. Luke Money, the Spencer Davis Group, the Yardbirds, Manfred Mann, plus half a dozen singles from the Who, Queen, with Jimi Hendrix. Combined with a mixture of neurotic emotions, psychotic anger and too many bruises. His father had been so drunk, he'd not noticed Paul take £9, 12 shillings and fourpence out of the Transport and General Workers Union wallet from the discarded blue overalls before leaving House of Horror and Hatred, which had once been his home. Stealing his father's money had been satisfactory revenge despite Paul's personality being imbued with a commendable aversion to theft and dishonesty. The rain had turned from tumultuous torrents to a misty mizzle, and Paul reached the motorway by 6:30 that morning. It took almost half an hour before a middle-aged man in a Ford Cortina, Ford gearbox and all, stopped to pick Paul up. By the time the car reached Luton services, Paul was beginning to feel hungry. The middle-aged man with a gearbox clanked his way off towards an anonymous direction, leaving Paul to attack a mixed grill and two mugs of hot tea. He knew he'd have to write to Peter as soon as he found somewhere to stay and some form of employment, which in London would surely be easier than maintaining the double life he'd been leading back in Birmingham. These thoughts climbed, fell, and bounced their way around his brain, along with uncertainty, doubts, and anxiety. This unstable state of mind did not abate, rather, it compounded as the Vauxhall Vector became his uneasy carriage to London. It was driven by a strangely dressed man with long hair, whom Paul had found so amicable as to relate his entire sad and sorry story. Even before reaching Notting Hill Gate, the man, who we shall call Damien, had told Paul his own story of squatting, of citizens' rights, dropping out, dropping in, dropping acid, and bad karma. Very little of which made any sense to Paul, except he knew the television and the daily sketch called such people hippies. Paul didn't know what to call them. He kept his guilty secret silent, for it seemed that squares and freaks alike had one thing in common. They were all totally straight, the boys going with the girls, while Paul went without. Paul is now 33 and works as a self-employed painter and decorator. Peter never did reply to his letters. Paul's parents have made no effort to contact him since 1968. Now it is 1986, and he still feels lonely and isolated from time to time, because, of course, everybody hates queers, don't they?
After the Apostles was an L.A. band called The Chiefs from 1980. They spelled their name C-H-E-I-F-S, and that song was called At the Beach at Tower 18. I guess I might clarify the distinction between making the JD's Top 10 tape and making their charts. Their zine lasted from 1985 to 1991, and they printed in most every issue a Hit Parade chart, but there was only one JD's actual tape. So getting back to the charts, two more that made the JD's Hit Parade were from 1985 by the Ugly Americans and their LP Who's Been Sleeping in My Bed. Together, they don't add up to a minute and a half. Here's Weenie Man and Homophobia.
One, two, three, four. I know a weenie man. He owns a weenie stand. He sells most everything from sausage on down. One day I'll share his life. I'll be his weenie wife. Hot dog, I love that weenie man. Sickle cell. Homophobia! Homophobia! Up my ass!
Let's close part one of my G.B. Jones interview with a band she much admired, the Dicks, led by openly gay Gary Floyd. They released an album in 1985 called These People, but you can more easily find this song on the CD comp The Dicks 1980-1986. Making the J.D.'s top 10 lists was their song Off-Duty Sailor.
You got it right!
Like I got hit with your bullet or something.